No live organism can continue for long to exist sanely under conditions of absolute reality. Even larks and katydids are supposed by some to dream. Hill House, not sane, stood by itself against its hills, holding darkness within. It had stood so for 80 years and might stand for 80 more. Within walls, continued upright, bricks met neatly, floors were firm and doors were sensibly shut. Silence lay steadily against the wood and stone of Hill House, and whatever walked there walked alone.
I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren.
And we are the Rance Macabre, covering all things horror.
With every episode, we explore the genre with sharp focus and deep production.
We want you to love scary movies as much as we do, so we don't overshare plots or give spoilers.
So welcome back, listeners.
Happy holidays.
Yes, I'm very excited about today's show.
Yeah, as am I, for the second half mostly.
Yeah,
I think us both.
Yes. There was a few things that I was excited about, then I watched, and then got far less excited.
So this was your first time watching the original 1963, The Haunting.
It was. And quite honestly, it's going to be first and only.
That's fair.
Yeah, I will not watch it again.
I don't know that it's going to necessarily improve upon a second viewing.
I felt such irritation that I couldn't watch it again. And I don't know. Yeah, if part of it is like having zero tolerance because of being pregnant or something.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not pregnant. I felt that way.
Yeah, I was like very irritated.
So, okay, listeners, what you heard at the top of the show is the very famous opening to the novel by Shirley Jackson. It's regarded, I mean, I think a lot of kids even read it in school. It is an American classic. In its time, it was certainly like a bestseller. And when Robert Wise first read the review in Time magazine, like it caught his attention. I was saying up top, I feel guilty for not having read the novel.
Yeah.
I want to. I just haven't gotten around to it. I think I would probably enjoy it far more than I did the film adapted.
Yeah.
And so that's what we're going to be talking.
Beautiful Poe kind of shit, word painting.
Yeah.
Real nice.
Yeah. And I agree with the sentiment that it's got the best opening paragraph of a horror or ghost story ever. But yeah, so we're going to be talking about The Haunting initially, and then the later works adapted for Netflix recently by Mike Flanagan, The Haunting of Hill House.
Scandal, murder, insanity, suicide. The history of Hill House was ideal. It had everything I wanted. It was built 90-odd, very odd years ago, by a man named Hugh Crane, as a home for his wife and daughter in the most remote part of New England he could find. It was an evil house from the beginning, a house that was born bad. Hugh Crane's young wife died seconds before she was to set eyes on the house. She was killed when, for no apparent reason, the horses bolted, crashing her carriage against a big tree. Mrs. Crane was carried, lifeless is the word, I think, into the home her husband had built for her. Hugh Crane was left an embittered man, with a small daughter, Abigail, to bring up.
So 1963's The Haunting is an adaptation straight from the book. The IMDb synopsis is pretty, I mean, straightforward.
A scientist
doing research on the paranormal invites two women to a haunted mansion. One of the participants soon starts losing her mind. And apparently, also, there's another man there, but that didn't make it into the synopsis.
And another woman later.
Yeah.
So Shirley Jackson wasn't satisfied with the movie. Right. Neither were we.
No, because, and this is what I think Mike Flanagan does so well in The Haunting of Hill House, which, you know, we'll really, really get into. But in this one, Robert Wise says, you know, maybe this is a psychological thing and it's not supernatural. And Shirley Jackson says, no, it's supernatural. You're taking all the fun out of it. Knock it off. And Robert Wise is like, but maybe existential.
Yeah. Well, okay. So we'll get into it. So we've mentioned Robert Wise as the director.
Huge guy.
Yeah, he had a pretty amazing career. He was a sound effects editor first, and judging by a resume, he's a man with music in his heart.
Yes, but not only, he's also a man with horror in his heart. He did Cat People. He did the Karloff Body Snatcher. He did Star Trek One.
Yeah, that was horrifying. Padding out his career with West Side Story and The Sound of Music and Andromeda Strain, which has been on my to-do list since, yeah. I don't know, I guess I was a teenager. I just haven't gotten around to it.
One of those.
But yeah. So having worked his way up at RKO Radio Pictures, he was an editor. He edited Citizen Kane for Orson Welles. Like, that's a pretty amazing feat. And I think this is definitely a film that, you get the sense that, like, it was cut in camera. Like, there is such artistry to the compositions and the camera movement and the lighting and, like, exteriors using infrared film to sort of get you a crazy contrasty sky with Hill House in the forefront. Like, there's real craftsmanship to this work. It's just the story. And
it's the story
the
where it all goes wrong.
Doesn't really
one
pan out.
Of Robert Wise's films that I definitely want to mention. It's a film that I think I've mentioned on this show before, and it's Audrey Rose from 1977. If you have not watched it, watch that movie. Audrey Rose. It's an Anthony Hopkins film. He's a young man, which Anthony Hopkins is one of those people who was never. Like a young great. Man, you
oh,
know what
I
I'm
thought
saying?
You were gonna say he was never handsome the way like Christopher Walken was a beautiful
he was just
woman.
Never
younger.
Really, exactly. He looked like Scarlett Johansson. But Anthony Hopkins has always kind of been like a 50-year-old man. And Audrey Rose, beautiful story, and it's actually really, really well done. So that's a Robert Wise, definitely check out for sure-sies. But where this goes wrong, I don't think is Robert Wise at all. Where this goes wrong is the screenplay by Nelson Gidding.
Yeah, the adaptation changes the point of the story.
Yes.
And it's one thing if it's, I don't know, if you're adapting a comic book and you're kind of changing things here and there for the better. The, you know, overall betterment of the story and enjoyment for everybody. But what they took out were some of the more interesting elements. I'm glad they made it back into the miniseries, but holy hell, this could have used some help.
Yes, and I feel very much that the screenplay, the writer, Nelson Gidding, did not really get or respect women at all, because it is a story about an hysterical woman, much in the like same kind of vein as Barbara from Night of the Living Dead.
I wasn't sure where you were going with it. Okay. So the hysteric Nell is played by Julie Harris. Claire Bloom plays Theo. She was Hera in Clash of the Titans that I grew up with, the Ray Harryhausen stop motion animation. Medusa in that made me pee my pants. That was terrifying when I was a kid.
Did you read her IMDb page?
No. Does it sound like
it's
she might have written it?
Yeah. It's
or like her nephew? Her like website.
It's
nephew.
One of those. Just look it up. It's adorable. Like if you're like, my grandma did aww. This, you know, and you're like, I think that's a little overblown, but that's cool.
She might be my favorite in the movie. I think Claire Bloom as Theo. We've got Richard Johnson and a young Russ Tamblyn from also West Side Story and Twin Peaks, which I didn't realize was him until I started digging into it.
He's the doctor, the psychologist or whatever.
Yeah, and he comes back to play a psychologist in the miniseries. He's Nell's psychologist, oddly enough.
Russ Tamblyn's playing Luke Sanderson, who is not mentioned in the IMDb because who knows why. And he is actually the son, and the old lady who still owns Hill House sends him there essentially as punishment. It's very weird, like why, because he's going to inherit the house, so she's like, just put him in the house. It makes no sense.
Right. Is he there kind of assessing? I mean, he spends a lot of time kind of talking about turning this place into what it's going to be. And
he's there because the old lady made him go there.
Right. But he's also kind of checking it. He's checking out his inheritance.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
He's got money in his eyes.
He's the most annoying character. Well, no, that's a lie.
It's a competition between him and Nell.
Yeah, him and Nell. Yeah. Which is probably why they became twins in Haunting of Hill House when they split those names up later.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't really considered that. That's funny.
Like twins in annoyingness.
So, yeah, Julie Harris plays our, hysterical woman in this version. And I don't think she's very good in this.
I don't think
she's a great actress, at least in this. You were telling me that she's won several Tonys.
5-time Tony winner.
I mean, she probably improved with time.
She was in her late 30s at this point.
But the Tonys, did they precede all this?
No, they were after. I mean,
those are like career Tonys. Yeah, those are over time.
You're really working this. Literally, the note that I have next to her is the worst. And then I have underlined the word the.
Yeah. I'm someone who generally likes voiceover. It's kind of taboo when it comes to screenwriting. It's considered amateurish and really lazy writing. I generally love voiceover. I couldn't really put my finger on exactly why. But this is one place I hate it.
I don't think it
works. I think it feels like empty and melodramatic.
It was very melodramatic,
yeah.
Very much. And so let's just kick it off. The way that this starts, you're introduced to Eleanor or to Nell, and her sister and her brother-in-law are assholes to her. And at first you're like, these people are so mean.
And then you get to know her.
And then Nell starts this blinking shenanigans. And that's, I think I'm supposed to feel sorry for her.
Yeah.
But I don't.
That was my takeaway.
And then she steals their car just because she wants to go stay in this house. And then makes the decision that she's going to stay in this house forever as she's driving down the road. Like, no turnsies, backsies. She's decided. That's it.
How bad it was taking care of her mother. And that's kind of her character. I mean, she's not given much to work with, but she's kind of been cloistered, taking care of her mother, and so she hasn't gotten a chance to live her own life, and I guess without a job or really any finances or resources, she winds up living on her brother's couch.
Yes.
And that's her character. And
yes.
We get the impression that she's psychologically delicate even
yes.
then. She's maybe prone to freaking out under pressure.
Definitely prone to blinking. That's the only thing they kind of give her to work with.
Yeah, I was thinking about like this being 63. Okay, so it's also in black and white, the way Psycho made a decision to be in black and white in 1960. Psycho feels way more modern than this does.
Didn't the car scene to you when Nell is driving and stealing the car really remind you of Marion? I was like, this is such a ripoff, I can't even deal with it.
Yeah. Yeah, that kind of bothered me.
All my life, I've been looking for an honestly haunted house. In the interests of psychic research, you must let me have it for a few weeks during my leave of absence.
No one who rented Hill House ever stayed for more than a few days. The dead are not quiet in Hill House.
So, the star of the movie really is the house.
Yes.
Which, I mean, all credit to the set designers. It was a set on the MGM Studios in England. The exterior, I guess, is at Eddington Park, which is now the Eddington Park Hotel. How dope would it be to stay at Hill House?
Beautiful. Yeah, that'd be awesome.
It's pretty amazing from the outside. I mean, the exteriors, I guess the building itself was on the grounds, like, along with the cemetery. And there's a story that Tamblyn tells about having the shit scared out of them on that property. But so the interiors are entirely manufactured. And pretty shocking. Like it looks like money. It looks like a lot of money.
It's
went
nice
into
stuff. What's yeah. also so it's overstuffed, very much like gaslighting. It's just overstuffed with shit. And you can see though into every single corner. And what the set designer or the set dresser has also done with all this shit that's going on in there is put ceiling on it.
Yeah.
So that there is, you know, this ceiling and this kind of closed in space, even though some of these rooms are very vast and the outside of the house is very vast, we still have this roof on everything. Also, I mean, something for Robert Weiss, like, that didn't fuck up the sound. The sound is not weird in this film. And when you put a ceiling on a room, on a set, on a soundstage, sometimes it sounds terrible.
Yeah, it can. I think at that point, all the stuff in it probably absorbs a lot of the what would be echo, because some of these spaces are pretty massive. And that is an interesting dynamic, that some of the rooms, the hallways, certainly, like, they're expansive, but the movie really pushes the claustrophobic effect. And I think part of that is kind of manufactured. There's a IMDb trivia tidbit about Robert Wise using 30 millimeter anamorphic wide angle Panavision lenses, which were ahead of their time and frankly, like, not ready to be used, and they would cause a little bit of distortion around the edges. So in terms of getting, like, close-ups but still getting a lot of the room, that's how he was doing it. But he was, you know, kind of sacrificing image quality in some of the corners. But I don't know, he moves the camera so well in these spaces. It's really, I don't know, it's frustrating that like, there's so much to like about this. It's just the acting sometimes falls flat.
The acting and the writing is god awful.
I remember reading that The Haunting is one of Martin Scorsese's favorite films, if not his favorite horror film. And why that kind of reminded me of something, Scorsese is someone who actors talk about how he composes a frame. He knows exactly what he wants it to look like. The lighting is perfect. And within that setting, he lets the actors play. And so it's more often than not, it's visuals first, content second.
Yeah.
And I could see this falling to his liking.
Because, yeah, beautiful film, cannot stand the acting. Let's talk, though. You liked Theodora. You liked Theo.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was incredibly bold that, like,
she was gay. Yeah, that's pretty amazing, right?
It's pretty wild that that's in the forefront, and that it's 1963, but they're kind of treating her psychic ESP abilities legitimately.
Yes, I really did like that.
That was pretty bold.
Thank heaven somebody's here. Oh, my name's Eleanor Lance. I'm so glad you're here.
I'm Theodora, just Theodora. What about this crazy house?
I'm right next door. We have a connecting bath.
This one used to be the embalming room, I bet.
It was terrible being here alone.
I set dinner on the dining room sideboard.
Where's
six.
Markway? I thought he'd have been here before anyone else.
You serve yourselves. I clear up in the morning.
Have you known Dr. Markway long?
I have breakfast ready at 9.
No, I've never met him.
I don't stay after 6, not after it begins to get dark.
My only contact with him has been our correspondence about the, quote, experiment, unquote.
I leave before the dark comes, so there won't be anyone around if you need help.
I liked that she got clothes. She was the only one who was dressed, and there was a special note in the opening credits that she's dressed and her by Mary Quant. So, you know, she's different.
Yeah.
You know, she's
a mod.
She's a beatnik, right? She's cool. And I think, like, that was kind of just code for she's gay. Beware.
She is quick to, like, offer Nell her room, or, like, share the bed with her.
And they're going
to
be best friends and stuff like that.
Yeah, that happened fast. So while the movie doesn't ever really lean into the ghost stuff, I mean, there's no apparitions. It's really down to, like, the sound design.
Yeah.
There's hard knocking. There's pounding on the walls.
A little bit of spooky writing with chalk that he tastes to say that this is chalk.
Yeah. What else might it have been? Like white dog poop. But no. What, like, what? Why would someone, like, use their detective skills in that moment to, like, scratch something off a wall and put it in their mouth?
Never in my mind do I think, what is this? My mouth will tell me what this is. Why did people do that?
My tongue is on the case. It's,
Use your eyeballs, dummy.
What could, like, best case scenario? I guess chalk is best case scenario.
Best case scenario is that it's powdered sugar that someone's put on the wall.
I guess it could have been powdered sugar.
That's how we get ants.
Do you want ants? Because that's how we get ants. Because I disliked Julie Harris throughout, I wasn't really afraid of what she was afraid of when she starts, like, winding down. I didn't really care. What I did really like is the scene that they're all together and the door expands.
Mm-hmm.
That was like maybe the only time that they put money into the scare, aside from having extras and, you know, people pound
on
the walls.
It's the only scare. Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of is.
Because even the pounding is not a jump scare. You know what I'm saying? It's just kind of like, oh, this is fucking happening now.
Yeah. There's an occasional, like, that door wasn't open a second ago. Snap, zoom. But, yeah, there's not a lot to be afraid of in this movie.
No. One of my favorite things is at the very beginning, and I should have known right from then and there, Dr. Markway is like, this door keeps opening and closing or whatever. And then they all just stare at the door, and then you as the audience member think the door is going to close.
Yeah.
But it just stays open, and I was like, upon finishing the film, I thought, that's this whole fucking movie in one scene.
We're waiting for a scare that never comes.
I'm still waiting for that door to snap shut, god damn it.
Okay, so while one adaptation isn't exactly accurate and authentic, I think Mike Flanagan might have made Shirley Jackson a lot happier with his version of it.
Listen, I loved this series, and I love Mike Flanagan.
Yeah.
And I get excited whenever he is attached to anything, especially Dr. Sleep. I can't wait.
He just tweeted that they wrapped on Dr. Sleep. I reposted
it
on the Rant's Twitter page because I was puzzled that, like, he directed each episode of the miniseries. He wrote a couple. He co-wrote a couple. Each one is a short film.
Yes.
And he goes from that, which was on the back of Hush, and then he goes right into Dr. Sleep. The fucking guy doesn't sleep.
It's like, amazing.
There's not enough hours in the day.
And I'm just so excited whenever he's involved in something, because I think he is one of the few people right now who is getting adaptations right.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? I said Hush, and I meant Gerald's Game. Gerald's Game was on the back of Hutt. Like, the guy is relentless.
Yeah.
And I, how are you that good, that consistent? Like, fucking Quentin Tarantino takes him 8 years to make a movie, and the last couple have fucking sucked.
Right. And this guy's cranking them out not only just writing, directing, all these things. He's doing it also on a Netflix budget, which is really not to be overlooked. You know, because yes, Netflix is pumping a lot of money into these things, but it's not the same thing as a full studio.
Right, right. Yeah, this was, I guess, brought to him by Amblin Entertainment, that's Steven Spielberg's crew, and I guess he, you know, was given an opportunity that he couldn't pass up because he took it on, and like I said, he's produced, he's written, he's directed a huge chunk of this. I think in the process, him and Kate Siegel had just had a kid, and then she discovered she was pregnant like a couple weeks or a month into filming, so like another baby now. Like, he's just like making family as he goes. Again, I don't know where he finds the time.
Mike Flanagan, the only thing I will say that's kind of like, okay, and whatever, because fine, everyone's beautiful, but he has a very special look he likes on his ladies in his movies.
Okay.
So sometimes I can't always tell the difference between Kate Siegel and Carlo Gugino, just in general, like on red carpets, things like that.
Okay.
But also, like, everyone looks the same. Everyone looks sort of like, yeah, but he uses them in every film. So I was like, in Dr. Sleep, how's this going to go down?
It's funny. I do really like the almost community theater component of his films. Like,
it's like Christopher Guest, but for scary movies, and I enjoy like that a great deal.
Yeah, I like that comparison.
Stevie, get up.
Dad? What's going on?
Get up. We gotta get out of here right now.
Why?
Quietly, quietly.
My shoes.
Shh.
So here we've got Henry Thomas and Timothy Hutton both playing Hugh Crane. In the novel, Hugh Crane is the original husband who built the house and lost two wives to it. His daughter then went on to live out her days there, but, you know, tragedy has lived at Hill House as long as the people have. The series turned the roles into a family, which I really like that,
yes,
that
me too.
Take on it. And again, the like community theater dynamic where
most of these actors are around the same age, so like, how do you work them all in? Well, we've got flashbacks. We've got
we're living in 1992 flashbacks.
Yeah, Henry Thomas and Carlo Gugino as the parents in the early 90s. I also like that it's contemporary and it's familiar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Carlo Gugino plays Olivia Crane, the wife and mother to the children, and the children kind of get the rest of the roles in terms of the homage from the original film and novel. We've got Kate Siegel playing Theo. She's kind of the middle child.
When she shows up on the show, I don't remember seeing her as a little kid previous to when she shows up. And then suddenly she's there. I go, who's this extra kid? I don't even remember her in the car.
The cast of kids, like, because there are twins, you kind of forget how many kids there are in total.
Yeah.
So there are the two youngest. That's Luke and Nell. And those are the twins.
The only thing I didn't totally care for was the little kid who was Luke.
Really?
I don't think that's cute.
Was it a little too saccharine? His big glasses, his Coke bottle glasses,
that he always
and the bowler
looks
hat.
Yeah. No, thank you.
He speaks fluent little kid. That kid was a little archetypal in terms
of
like...
Yeah, it was too much for me.
I liked him. Okay, so we've got Shirley and Steven as the two oldest. Shirley is like the sister who is always like put in charge of the other kids. So she's kind of... She's taken on this responsibility begrudgingly, but she's just, you know, along for the ride, and she's a trooper.
And you're from a big family. Like, there's only me, so I never had to take care of other people, and you're the baby.
I am the baby. I was the pain in the ass. This family doesn't really have a brat like I was.
I think Luke would be, like, the...
But he's very sweet.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
You were bad.
I was spoiled. I was solidly spoiled until I was about 10, at which point I started to like.
Because how many others
myself.
Are you? There's
my older brother, who's the next immediate oldest, and then my older sister Melissa, who is 5 years to the day, and that resentment held on for a while. I was born on her fifth birthday. When they brought me home, she took me out of my crib and dropped me.
Oh, good. That's what's wrong.
Supposedly. Accidentally. and then Tanya is 2 years older than her. So we're all relatively close in age.
Okay.
So, I mean, familiar, yeah, to this. Although this family, they've got almost like that bond that like families in this case, their parents are like home flippers. They're like renovators.
Right.
And so they've moved around a bit. And the family kind of is a pretty tight unit who gets along. Like they're not. There's not really bratty kids here,
No.
Which is surprising that, like, there's not one behavior. You have five kids. There's not one behavioral problem? What is it?
That is kind of strange, right?
And, I don't know. Now that I'm saying it out loud, I'm a little skeptical.
Maybe they're all ghosts.
So that's the dynamic that brings them to Hill House. According to, you know, Hugh Crane, they're going to be there like a month or two over the summer and relocate in time for the kids to go to school.
Right.
And they must be really good at it because they have picked a fixer-upper that is like entirely authentic. It's as if they should have known better because everything in that house was original.
And it didn't seem like too terrible. Like this is similar to Don't Be Afraid of the Dark because they're house flippers in that one.
Yeah.
But, like, I felt like that house was a mess and they had to fix this. This was in very good shape.
Yeah. This was kind of like when you see in movies where they put, like, dust covers on everything. Like, it was kind of that. Like, everything was where it should have been. And I wonder when I don't think we ever get, like, an initial assessment. We just kind of start picking up when things are going wrong.
I don't understand how much money they're going to actually get out of this house because they do seem to hire people to do things in their house.
But I guess along with the staff are the Dudleys, mm-hmm. a very Catholic, or at least Mrs. Dudley is very Catholic. And they are like house staff who live down the block. And this much is directly out of the book and the original film where they kind of come with the house. And
right. If
that's ever like that's a sign. That's a red flag. Like,
yes, it is. Also that Mrs. Dudley is very strange and very stilted.
Yeah.
And I think it's on purpose because, you know, her from the X-Files.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, so she doesn't act like that on The X-Files. So she's doing this very, like, weirdly stilted thing. And for a lot of when I'm watching it, I was going, is she a ghost? Is she real?
It kind of felt like it might have gone that way.
Right, yeah. Right. But her and her husband, yeah, live across the woods. Fair enough.
So Steven is the oldest brother. He's in adulthood, played by, how do you pronounce
He's
this?
From the Netherlands, like Holland. So Michael Huisman, if you would do it French.
I'm glad you said it and not me.
I don't know. You know, yeah. It's not probably like he's listening, being like, ah, they ruined my name.
God damn it. Yeah. He's from Game of Thrones. And I think he's actually a really good pairing as like the son of Henry Thomas. He looks like, you know, they might have had.
He did a good job like matching this family up for sure-sies.
Yeah. And so Steven's character is kind of the like well-adjusted skeptic of the family as the oldest one. Early on in the series, we do get the family as children. This is in the flashback where the dad is. We don't realize that one by one he has grabbed all the kids and put them in the family.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to say caravan, but like
station wagon. Yeah.
Yeah. Steven is the last one to go, and his father tells him, close your eyes and don't open them. And he carries him like a little kid out the door in a hurry. And Steven, I mean, we get a, like, he gets a glimpse. He gets a glimpse of someone coming down the hall. And it's kind of scary, but doesn't seem to terrify him at the time.
So if you are in that situation, and I know your father, and your father says, don't look, I'm carrying you out of the house, we're gonna run, would you open your eyes? Would you look?
No fucking way.
You would trust your dad. You'd be like, yes, okay, I won't.
If he did it now, I would certainly keep my eyes closed. At the time, I don't know if I was that disciplined of a little kid. I might be too tempted to open my eyes.
Me
but
too.
If I was terrified, I'd probably keep them shut. You know what? It's funny. I've mentioned it on the show before, but when I was a little kid and I was dragged along with the family because they couldn't find a sitter, when we went to see Nightmare on Elm Street 4, I pinched my eyes closed so tightly and willed myself to sleep eventually.
That's what you would have done. You would have been lulled into a nice sleep.
You know what? It wouldn't have taken long once I was in the car to fall asleep. I just would have, you know, gotten there sooner. I'd be hopefully asleep by the time the door closes behind me.
I would have looked because curiosity is my downfall.
Yeah.
It's going to definitely be my downfall.
Also,
secret door in my basement.
Gonna
open it. So everyone's put in the car and we're driven off and we don't know what's going on. We know mom's not here.
Right.
And this is kind of how we're flashing back and forward. It seems very much like Henry Thomas has done something really bad, right?
Yeah.
That's how you're kind of meant to believe.
Yeah. And because that is kind of the story to be resolved, at least for the, like, you know, 2/3 of the miniseries, you do kind of have this same, like, the children have resentment of their father.
Yes.
They are frustrated and they just don't have his side of the story because, you know, in his words, he's trying to protect them from it.
And they go live then with their aunt, and that's kind of how they're raised then. And so they do have this resentment. I think, to me, what I think I just love about this TV show is how real it is and how it is a family at the core.
Yeah.
The house is just the place that it's happening. But it is this family, and it is dysfunctional. Everyone has problems with everyone else, even though when they were kids, they were all seemingly good and not fighting. But
yeah,
everyone's fighting as adults.
It's funny. They waited to adulthood to be like melodramatic teenagers.
And they all have different problems, different things with each other in different ways.
Yeah. And so that element I really liked. And it seems kind of on the rare side in terms of haunting stories. You know, we've all kind of watched these movies time and time again where, you know, don't go in there. It's a pretty traditional haunted house kind of setting. Something terrible has happened. That space is haunted. Stories like the Amityville Haunting, the film at least, whatever evil is in there kind of spreads and latches onto people. And that's more of what we've got here in terms of this family has left the haunted house, but the haunted house has not left the family.
Yes, I mean, there is supernatural you know, things going on. But you do spend so much of the show in what I think that Robert Weiss kind of had wanted, which was saying, are these people just really depressed, or really is this a story of mental illness, or is this stuff really happening?
Yeah, although there are little flares and touches and, you know, occasionally jump scares, but there's just enough to kind of keep piquing your interest.
Yes.
That, like, there's always going to be a little something more than just the, like, person trouble.
Right.
And I really love that. And because the story kind of, over 10 episodes, kind of unfolds like Rashomon style, where we get these individual paths of the different children, I really like the way the story is unfolded. Each one, like, even the characters I wasn't that wild about, I like the stories that involve them. I've really dug it.
I think very similar to the 63 Haunting, where there's stuff in every corner.
Mm-hmm.
This is a film where you're always looking at the corner.
Yeah.
And I keep saying film, and I mean show, but I can't get it right because it is like this big film, this big epic film.
Yeah.
But there is scary shit in every freaking corner.
I
love that.
I think I've just about watched every episode twice. But I still haven't, like, I've got to turn off all the lights in the house and really
focus on it.
Because apparently there's a lot more ghost activity than is apparent on a first
viewing. Yes. There are so many scary, scary ghost either faces or feet or shadows or things. It is crazy. The statues are moving. I mean, like, every single part of this has
did
been
the
well
statues
that
move? I kind of assumed they did. I just didn't catch it ever.
Yeah. It's really amazing.
The house, yes, it's a set, but I think they've done a great job at sort of capitalizing on a couple expansive rooms. The original film, you know, really does up the spiral staircase room. And here in the house, we've got that spiral staircase room, but we've also got like a sort of sculpture gallery behind the like large front hallway and staircase.
It's like an atrium in that
way. There's the kids' bedrooms, which all seem like, you know, they all down the same hallway lined with statues. So like even every time the door is open, there's a glimpse of statues, if not the people themselves kind of, you know, haunting their own house.
That spiral staircase, the open spiral staircase, the one made out of metal.
Mm-hmm.
There is a church in London, St. Paul's Cathedral, and it's a tourist kind of thing. And that's where I discovered on a set of stairs very similar to that, where you could just keep seeing down and walking up them,
yikes,
that I was terrified of heights.
That's a bad time to find that
it
out.
It was really bad. It was like a full-blown panic attack. I was the sweatiest person in town.
Oh, wow.
And Jackson was literally following me up behind me, trying to push my butt up the stairs because it was panic. Because
why up and not down?
Couldn't go down. I had to go up. You have to go up to go down.
Was there were like a line of tourists doing the same?
Yeah.
Oh.
And those stairs were so terrifying. And then seeing them in the 63 Haunting and then also in this show, I was like, that's terrifying. That's terrifying. There's the terror right there. Because you can see all the way down.
Yeah.
And me, myself, I can see my death as I fall over it. That's what I see. But Jackson behind me trying to push me and I'm like, hey, don't touch me. I'm going to crawl my hands and my feet up these stairs.
Oh,
so certain things that happen to certain characters when they go ascend those stairs, that's not going to happen to me because I won't go up those stairs.
That's funny. Rachel's work also has a spiral staircase connecting. Her office has like a, you know, two floors connected by the spiral staircase. And similarly, there is like a cord in the middle that can be tightened or loosened. For what reason
would
be loosened, I have no idea. But it will shake accordingly depending on the tightness of that center cable.
Yes. No. That's just not a good design.
No. I don't get it. Although, aesthetically, and I don't really have a problem with heights, I really like the idea of a spiral staircase. It seems very space efficient.
Yeah, I mean, I never knew I did until I was on the spiral staircase.
And then it's like never, never again.
Never again. Now I know.
Nell, Luke, Theo, they were just kids. The things they told you in confidence.
I'm clear that they were kids.
You make Mom sound fucking crazy.
Oh, Mom wasn't crazy?
And the Dudleys and Dad? This is the worst of the bullshit. Worse than the tabloids.
Dad had every opportunity to set that straight. What am I supposed to write? He said it was haunted. Those are his words.
It was a wreck. He just lost his wife.
And he hasn't said shit since. Does he talk to you, Cheryl? Did he tell you what happened that night? Because all I've got are those tabloid quotes. He refuses to tell us anything else.
He believed it, Steve. When he said those things, he believed them. In the moment, at least. And you never did.
Neither did you.
And now you're digging up that stuff for a buck? So you can stop living off credit for a change?
Box. Look, I can tell that you're upset.
So we've talked about most of the first episode. In terms of our characters, we've met just about everybody, at least as kids. And so Stephen, the oldest, grows up to be the writer, the one who tells the story for profit.
And, right, and doesn't believe it.
Right, that he is the skeptic. I kind of like that. As the start, because he kind of does play the role of like the original psychologist kind mm-hmm. of in investigating the haunted house. But as the skeptic, he pisses off his siblings. You know, they see it as him exploiting the family tragedy. And at this point, we sort of absorb that Mom is gone.
Right.
Carly Gugino never made it out of that house.
Right.
And that they grew up without a mother, and he kind of sees the telling of the haunting of Hill House as his opportunity. And, you know, the publisher certainly appreciates that, like, he is capitalizing on the tabloid spectacle that was the original story. Because, you know, it wasn't the story didn't die with the mom. It kind of hit the tabloids, and while the family was never public about the stories, you know, people got to know about this house, you know, indirectly. And so he kind of turns it into a career. He starts showing up to famous haunted places and telling those stories. And we meet him in the process where he's responding to a woman's claim that she witnesses, or I guess just the one time, her husband appear over her bed.
Right.
In the position where he died, I guess, like a mile down the road, you know, in a terrible car accident. And he's respectful in terms of her experience, but he lets her know that, like, I don't believe any of this shit. She's right. Like, but you've written fucking 6 books.
And he's just like, no, thank you.
When I said I've never seen a ghost, it's not exactly true. I've seen a lot of ghosts, just not the way you think. A ghost can be a lot of things. A memory, a daydream, a secret, grief, anger, guilt. In my experience, most times they're just what we want to see.
Why would I want to see my Carl like that?
Because it's better than never seeing him again. Most times a ghost is a wish.
In every episode, there is some character, and it's not usually one of the main characters, giving a monologue. Do you notice?
Yeah.
And that one in that particular case, I thought she was good. That's like one of those old-fashioned ghost stories where you shine the flashlight in the dark.
Yeah.
And tell this ghost haunting story. And she was awesome, that actor. So in the very end of the first episode, we do know that Nell goes back to the house, the littlest sister, and that's essentially what kind of kicks off this whole series, is the family now has to deal with each other because they are kind of all estranged from one another, but they have to come back for the funeral of their little sister.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it's a heavy note to end on, but it really kind of kicks off the series in that moment.
Nell?
Daddy.
Honey, are you okay? What time is that?
Do you remember the bent neck lady?
Yes.
She's back.
Okay. Nell, where are you?
I'm at home. In bed.
I want you to go to Stephen Lee's. I'm going to drive to Orlando and get a flight to L.A. Steve's closest, so you go to him. Okay, now I'll see you there tomorrow.
Okay. Okay. I love you, Daddy.
Are you okay?
I'm fine. I'm sorry to wake you. Good night, Daddy.
The second episode then features kind of Shirley. That's the Shirley episode. And it's about death as well, because we know that Nell has died in the very first episode. So we're going into this, and Shirley and death go hand in hand. They always have. And I feel similar to Shirley, because I am the person who always finds the dead pet.
Oh,
that's my lot in life, is to be that person.
That's a burden.
It really sucks. It's like the worst thing ever, but it's always me. But Shirley finds these kittens as a child. Shirley finds these kittens. They're all like fucked up, distempery. It doesn't look good. She puts them in the box to heaven. We used to call that the box to heaven.
Oh, boy.
Because we had, I lived on a farm and we had farm cats.
Yeah.
And like, if you made it out of the box to heaven, good on you. But usually you didn't.
Yeah, they're kind of left behind. And I guess in the way that animals can kind of abandon those that are sick or, irreparable in this case. Like, Shirley becomes their keeper. And that doesn't pan out so great.
No. And I think that's what really kind of shapes Shirley to be who she is as an adult, which is a mortician.
Yeah. I really liked, I was a huge fan of Six Feet Under on HBO.
I never watched it.
You should. That could be your next series. Although, I mean, it flows between, like,
I love
really
that redheaded actress.
And really funny. Yeah, she's great. She's also an opera singer.
She's very good.
Yeah. So the way that show kind of, brings us behind the curtain and humanizes this profession that is, I'm going to say, it doesn't really get enough respect, considering, it is interesting that, like, it's a whole, like, it's like becoming a doctor, essentially training to be a mortician, especially if you're going to be the, like, makeup fixer-upper of bodies mortician,
if that's your role.
The thing
is, like, many times a mortician is like the doctor, coroner, the fixer-upper, the beautician, and also a business person.
Yeah.
Because usually it's a family-owned kind of business, and there's not a lot of people who do it.
Yeah. And Shirley, as a child, we get the scene where she is at her mother's funeral, and they all know that her mother died in a pretty rough, like, physically traumatic way. Mm-hmm. And that Shirley is looking at her mother as she was in life, and she's puzzled, and she has that really sweet moment with the mortician, who kind of explains to her, it's like, that's what we do. It's like, we make her what you remember her being. The professionalism with which she takes care of, this was one episode that I really liked the writing, particularly Shirley's writing, that she is kind of able to shut off a certain amount of emotionality, and in this case, like, go through with the mortician's job of preparing her sister for her own funeral. Like, that was heavy and difficult, but, like, she's a fucking trooper, and she gets through it, and she gets the family prepared to show up, and someone's got to pick up dad, and arrangements have to be made, and she's elbow deep in guts, and she makes that point known. Like, yeah, it was pretty heavy, and yeah, that was the episode that follows this. Like, this was a heavy twofer, these two surrounding the death of Nell.
And what I like is the very big difference between Shirley and Theo, and we discover that Theo now, as an adult, lives outside in kind of like the guest house garage of Shirley's mortician house
funeral home.
I was like, what do you call those things? Which is so gross. Like, can you imagine living above a bunch of dead bodies?
I wonder if they also had like a crematorium. That might be gross.
That
if
would
you
be
live
gross.
down stream from that downwind from a crematorium.
I assume you have to do that not in a community.
I mean, it depends. Actually, that's a good question. I wonder about that.
Seems like toxic.
Return of the Living Dead. I guess they were just by a cemetery. That was pretty remote. Return of the Living
Dead.
They
were very remote. The house was out of ways. Probably shouldn't use that as realism. But we find out that Theo does live next door. Theo loves wearing gloves.
Yeah. At first, you kind of think of it as like, well, that's a unique style. But yeah. It pretty quickly becomes apparent that like this, you know what, the first 15 minutes of processing her wearing gloves, I was like, maybe she has psoriasis or something. Like, maybe
she's yeah, got... I was like, I don't know why she's doing this. She just doesn't like to touch things. Meh. I took it as that. And that's where I wrote it off in my mind.
Your grandmother was like that, too. She was sensitive. I've wondered if you and your sisters might be a little sensitive. Shirley says some things sometimes when she's sleeping that are, well, they're interesting. And I asked Nellie what she thought about the house when we moved in. She said it was loud. Such an odd word she chose. Noticed you always wore sweaters inside, even though it's summer. Why is that?
Because it's always cold.
Grandma Mary was like that, too. She hated the air on her skin. She was always bundled up. Sensitive people, they sometimes need... Well, these will help with the cold. And the other thing.
But we find out, just like in The Haunting, it's because she has, like, ESP.
It's like the contact... psychic ability that Christopher Walken had in The Dead Zone.
Yeah.
Like, she's highly empathic. And because she is a child psychologist, like, she's kind of capitalized on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she went to school and she did the due diligence. And it is funny that, like, she's a doctor. She is all the way a doctor. She's living in her sister's guest house. Like, that's...
Right.
It's a weird life choice. But again, like, you know,
well, later on,
sister.
Then we kind of... She kind of says why she is living there, and she kind of explains it a little bit, you know, because Shirley's kind of a uppity bitch, and she needs someone to be there to be like, hey, get your shit together, quit being so self-righteous.
A project, like the Forever House.
Yeah.
The third episode is called Touch, and it was, like all episodes, directed by Mike Flanagan, this time written by Liz Fang, who wrote some episodes of The Strain. She's done some television, but not a lot of horror. And I thought that was a really interesting and good call, because this episode is so emotionally dense. It's quite a swinging pendulum. This is a Theo-heavy episode. We kind of get the full picture that Theo has... supernatural insight.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's had it as a kid. And I like this, that this was a little bit of a nod to the original in terms of Theo always being cold. And
right.
Specifically in Hill House, she you know, kind of talks about the whole house being cold. Whereas Carlo Gugino's kind of stuck on occasional, like there's a spot where it just, there's
right.
not an understandable draft. It's just a weird cold spot in the house. And Theo walks through going, this whole house is cold.
Right.
I thought it might be her.
Mrs. Dudley? She never stays after dark. What are you doing?
Trying to take a ride in this elevator.
Dumbwaiter.
Come on, you stupid thing.
But the door has to be closed.
But then I can't reach the buttons.
You're a crazy kid. You know that?
Just one ride. I know it works. Please, Theo.
I'm gonna get in trouble.
I won't tell. Please, come on. It's a perfect kid-sized elevator.
Fine. You hop straight out and you don't tell anyone I did this for you. Okay?
Okay.
You ready?
Going up!
Listen, dumbwaiters are scary as hell.
I always thought, I don't remember where it's the first time I saw him, but when I became aware of the idea, I was like, I would have killed for a dumbwaiter in the house I was growing up in. Like, that seems as cool as, like, hidden passageways.
We used to, in my great-grandparents' house, they had a dumbwaiter that then was taken out, and then it became, like, a slide, and you would throw your laundry.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Like, down that, but originally it was a dumbwaiter. And we would sometimes slide down the slide. And it's like, as now, like a person who's now seen a lot of scary films, I would never do that. Never, never, ever. So we're treated to this incredibly scary dumbwaiter thing, which you know is going to be fucking scary.
Yeah.
You know it. And yet Luke, there he goes, gets in the frickin' dumbwaiter.
I love that he's so insistent. And he gets Theo to, I guess, push the button for him. What we know of Hill House is that the structure is odd. They don't have full blueprints for the house. But, yeah, so without giving away the scare, the house, it turns out, is kind of poorly mapped on purpose. It was once the home of a bootlegger.
Right.
And they needed a certain amount of space in the basement to keep illegal liquors and wines, and in that dusty basement space is all kinds of terror and horror, and Luke gets a firsthand glimpse of it, and they, you know, finally, he, you know, screams to holy hell. They finally get him back upstairs, and his pajamas are missing a big chunk
yes.
of fabric that he could not have torn himself.
Terrifying.
I love that moment. It's my favorite. It might be my favorite scare in the whole show.
It was so scary.
It was a really good build.
And so we have this terrifying, and I mean like terrifying scare, that's now being juxtaposed with the current time and the scary Mr. Smiley of one of Theo's patients, children
yeah.
patients.
Yeah, so Theo, I guess you catch it. That when she's shaking hands with adults, the gloves are on.
Right.
When she's dealing with the kids, the gloves are off.
Right.
And that she kind of runs into this problem she can't figure out in this young girl. It baffles her, but she knows something's off.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the kid's in therapy, so something's off. Her adopted parents, you know, kind of talk about how she used to be this way, but now she's that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so Theo kind of puts on her investigator's hat and drops by the house kind of unannounced to kind yeah. of explore, because all she's gotten out of this young girl is it Mr. Smiley?
Mr. Faces Smiley, yeah, him? Who lives under the house. And it's one of those where it's a mystery what this Mr. Smiley is, and you think it's a ghost.
Yeah, that's kind of the direction things have been going. So when she is kind of, you know, she finds her way into the basement of this house, you know, the parents are upstairs. She's just, you know, she mm-hmm. talks about taking in the environment, trying to get inside the little girl's head, so to speak. Now the gloves are off and she's playing psychic detective.
Because it's
the
not
basement.
Just people. It is things and objects that she can also read from. And when you as the viewer are exposed to Mr. Smiley, it is not what you thought it was.
No, that scene was heavy. Kate Siegel is impossibly good, and this is the third episode, so we've had scenes with her. You know, she's kind of, I don't know, she's got the sexuality of like a college guy in terms
yeah.
of like she hits the clubs, she's
looking for a one and done kind of situation, but she's
yeah.
also kind of like, she's kind of mean.
Yeah, yeah, there's not a lot of, you know, no one's allowed to sleep over,
she's very
that
cold
kind of thing.
Yeah,
yeah, that we see this professional side of her. And it's interesting that, like, the professional side of her is the side that she's allowed of herself to, like, be open.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you know, that's kind of what the job takes, especially if you're an empath. But that she has this emotional turn, because so little is written in these scenes that it comes down to just the acting and
mm-hmm.
what's on camera. And in the span of time between body language and facial expression, and sometimes just like the cutaway to what she's looking at,
mm-hmm.
so much is said without any dialogue at all, and it's fucking heartbreaking.
Yeah.
It happens twice in this episode, where she, you know, the Mr. Smiley story resolves itself. But by the end of this episode, her sister has been delivered to the house and Shirley has done the work. And, you know, she is on the slab, on the table in the mortuary basement. And Theo brings herself to touch her sister because right. everybody's puzzled why her sister, who up to this point had been
doing good,
one of the most well-adjusted of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And young and full of potential, and that she took this hard turn, like Theo wants to get to the bottom of it. It just happens to be like on the worst possible week that she could have done it. And so when she touches her sister, that again, this is a scene without any dialogue. It's entirely right. in the body language, and it's fucking heartbreaking. And I think that was the first time I cried in the show.
I cried a lot. I don't know if that was the first one.
Cried twice in that episode. Maybe Mr. Smiley Face. I think I cried at the initial because that's really powerful as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, Theo's character, like, I don't know. Yeah, she really got me. So for this episode, we're going to leave it there. We're going to be back real soon with part two of The Haunting of Hill House. And we're going to be talking about episodes 4 through 10. Well, I think we're probably going to be very light on episode 10, so yeah. as to completely avoid any spoilers. But yeah, if you're listening to this, give us a subscribe click on iTunes or Google Play Music or Stitcher or Spotify. We're on Spotify
now. Yes, we are
now.
On Spotify, guys.
That's really exciting. Yeah, we're branching out. So hit us up on social media. We are at Rants Macabre on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. I've got some updating to do. I've slacked. This semester has kind of kicked my ass, so I've not been great about the upkeep on
social
media.
I go through phases where I'll be like, oh, retweet, or I'll write back to people and things like that, and I go through phases where I do it a lot, and then I go, I don't know, I'm at the point, especially in my pregnancy, where I just, if I sit on the couch, it's all over. It's all over.
It's like the sweatpants are on. I'm done. Yeah. So yeah, if you want to drop a line, we are therantsmacabre@gmail.com. If you're in the giving holiday spirit, as the cabs and honking cars are outside, clearly.
Yeah, why right now?
Yeah, it's pretty late considering. Yeah, you could swing by iTunes and give us a review. It helps us spread the show. Yeah, I think that'll do it for this episode. Like I said, we'll be back real soon with the second part of this. And a little Christmas treat we're still kind of figuring out. So yeah, that'll do it for me. This is Darren signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.